I've always been entertaining since the age of nine and competing in the same time. I would do, for example, in 2007, I did 170 shows.
What? In 1 year?
In 17 countries, in four continents.
Wow.
And I rode the World Cup, the European Championship, the World Championship.
Oh my God.
And I think I won the World Cup. So I've always been juggling my time. These shows were my income.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Repeat on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I'm joining you today from Bentonville, Arkansas, our springtime base for the year, as I continue my prep for Unbound Gravel. It's starting to get pretty warm and humid here, which is exactly what I need for that prep. That said, it hasn't quite been the smooth sailing work that I enjoyed during the winter buildup, unfortunately, as I got absolutely whacked by a really nasty upper respiratory bug after sea otter. Sounds like quite a few people ended up picking that up as well. And it's been pretty frustrating to sit on the sidelines instead of laying down those big hours before Unbound. But I'm finally starting to ease back into some real hours again. And I'm optimistic that I'll be able to pull a bit of form back together in time for the big one on June 1st. That said, the schedule is pretty packed before then too. And Kenny, today's guest, and I talk about that some in today's episode. More on that in a minute. But if you're not making it to Unbound this year, there are a couple of opportunities to come hang out or ride together before then. I'll be racing the Rule of Three here in Bentonville and leading the Shakeout Ride on Thursday, May 16th at 3:30 p.m. from the Hub Bike Lounge with last week's guest and fellow allied rider, Taylor Ledine. The week after that, I'll be at Bentonville Bike Fest, Kenny's event, and we'll be doing a signing and meet and greet type deal at the Orange Seal Tent, I think at 10 a.m. on Friday, May 24th, although stay tuned to the socials to double check and confirm that. Still firming that up a little bit. And speaking of Orange Seal, I would like to thank them for supporting today's show. They're my longest running sponsor, as I mentioned last week, and their tire sealant has saved many a race and training ride for me over the years. I run my bikes tubeless, all my bikes, mountain bike, gravel, road, and even the old commuter, because no one likes interrupted ride, even when you're just cruising to the coffee shop or whatever. And it's been a game changer for me in some pretty key moments as well. I remember puncturing early on at my first ever Leadville 100 back in 2017. I was coming down the infamous power line descent and smashed a rock with my back wheel. But Orange Seal sealed up the slice and sealed it up with like 15 PSI, and I only lost about 20 seconds as I just hit it with the CO2 quickly, was able to get back to the front, and ended up podiuming that day. So regardless of whether you're working towards a big goal or just want to make sure that your daily commute doesn't get interrupted, I highly recommend you go to orangeseal.com and pick up some tire sealant today. Lastly, quick bit on today's guest. I met Kenny Belay back in 2017, right around the time I signed with Red Bull, actually. He had already been a Red Bull veteran at that point, but this year marks 21 years with the brand. Pretty crazy, very inspiring. I've honestly never met a Red Bull athlete that wasn't hugely inspiring, but Kenny, in a lot of ways, kind of seems like the prototypical Red Bull athlete. He, of course, had an illustrious competitive career, 9-time world champion in trials, but also, you know, has had this almost like dogged, pesky creative streak that he has just never been able to put to rest, something I can certainly relate to. And it's driven him to do the incredible things that he's doing today. So please sit back and enjoy today's conversation, which we recorded live from the podcast studio in Ledger, Bentonville. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you after the show. All right, Kenny. Been a minute since I had fellow Red Bull athlete on the podcast. This is exciting. We were just comparing hats. Your hat has pockets on the side, zippered pockets. Very jealous. Could use that. I'm always losing things, so seems handy. I'm trying to remember where I met you. Obviously, we run into each other in Bentonville a lot.
It was during a Longhorn game, a Texas Longhorn game. I think you just signed Red Bull.
Really? And that was ages ago.
I was doing a show there for Red Bull.
Yeah.
I think it was for Red Bull, yeah.
A basketball game at the Drum in Austin.
Yes, yes. Texas Longhorn. And then we went on a mountain bike ride.
Yes.
I'm not sure you already had your Red Bull helmet.
I'm not sure I did.
Yeah, I think you got it like a few days or weeks after.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's, man, I totally forgot about that. So you've been in the basketball space for a while.
Yes, since 2012, so 12 years already.
Yeah.
Wow.
Doing halftime shows.
Yeah, so the first ones I did was in California, the Golden State Warriors. Yeah. Then I started wondering, like, there's so many teams, there's more potential, you know, and then I got like actually an email list of all the teams, so I started emailing them.
You got an email list of all the teams.
All the teams. And then I was like, that's
my way. Power.
Yeah.
Who slipped you that? Holy cow.
I can't say.
Dang, man.
It's top secret.
That is wild.
Yeah, no, that was, I think, key, but you know, it was a bit disappointing because there's like, I don't know what, 50 contacts on there and then three people replied.
Yeah,
like,
of course. Oh,
come on. And then, yeah, but you know, you never stop and put them in the newsletter, and then I got like 2 bookings, 5 bookings, 10 bookings. And then before I knew, I did like probably more over 20 teams right now.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been awesome.
So when you're, man, there's so many, everyone at this point that listens to the podcast will know that I'm a big basketball junkie.
Oh yeah.
And so naturally there's a bunch of different directions I want to take this. But one thing that comes to mind immediately as you're talking about pursuing doing halftime shows for various teams is why you wanted to do that. Is it just a job opportunity, or is it an exposure thing and you're kind of looking to elevate your brand and the other things that you're doing and use this huge platform that is the NBA to do that? Because I mean, I was watching a Mavs game earlier this year, and you were just there hopping around on your boxes, and one of the big boxes said Bentonville Bike Fest on the side, which uh-huh. We'll get to, and it has the dates on it. And so I was like, man, I mean, I could see Kenny happily doing this totally pro bono for free because the exposure is insane and it's going to support everything else. So what opportunity did you see, and why did you decide NBA?
Yeah, so in 2002, I started doing a lot of trial shows. Like, I mean, a lot. Like, every town in Belgium, every, like, sports awards, like, you know, all the small stuff, technically. It was a good, like, start for me to get to know how to entertain people, how to engage with people. And then from there on, like, Red Bull started hiring me a lot of the times in the Middle East, like Lebanon, all over the place, Japan. I think they sent me to, like, 30 countries. America always seemed to be like this impossible country to get into. But I always knew, like, you know, the country of entertainment, performances, athletes, that's always been my goal, the American dream, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And people told me, like, in Europe, you should go to Vegas and do, like, they have those theaters. And then I went to Vegas. I'm like, nah, this is not what I want to be associated with.
Interesting.
And then I was like, NBA, that must be awesome to do a halftime show, promote my sport in front of like a 20,000 people crowd. Yeah. And in 2010, I got hired by Adidas to do a big Adidas commercial in LA, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they called me and said, if you'll be in the spot, then you'll be amongst B.O.B., Katy Perry, David Beckham, Derrick Rose, all those guys. I was like, oh, really? So I went there, and then the level of execution, like, I've been part of a lot of photo shoots and film shoots, but the level of execution was like really Hollywood level.
Yeah.
In like L.A. River with like Mercedes ML with like a big crane on it and then like filming me, and like it was like I couldn't believe it. So this took my career. Like I already won a lot of championships and everything, but you know, as a trials rider, you're always like that, the underdog.
Okay.
And then that commercial took my career like to the next level. Like credibility went up. I was in all the newspapers.
Really? This was a TV ad?
It was the biggest Adidas commercial campaign actually ever. I think it had like 1.6 billion impressions. Yeah. I was on buses in Taiwan.
No way.
Airports, every Adidas store. Like it was like Lionel Messi and my head next to him.
Crazy.
I was like, man, America, that's where it's happening.
Yeah.
And then the pay was like the second commercial, the year after, I got hired again by the same crew for same space, same place, for a Samsung commercial with, again, with David Beckham. And like the pay was like something you can never get anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I was like, man, America's the place to be. Mm. And then shortly after I met Aaron Lutzi. He's a trials rider who actually started working for Red Bull. And I told him, Aaron, man, like, what about doing an NBA show? He's like, are you kidding me? We are sponsoring the Golden State Warriors. Our deal is that we have to provide two halftime shows. We got Terry Adams. You could be the second one.
No way.
I was like, all right. And that was like, it all just happened in the order. Like now, if I think about it, there's been like, you know, chronologically, there's been an order to it. But I think a lot of it depends on just pursuing it and always never stop promoting yourself in the end. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. No, it's very true. How many NBA shows are you doing now?
I mean, I have to be really honest, post-COVID, a lot of my focus went to the Bentonville Bike Fest.
Yeah.
So before, when I came to the States, it was always about NBA shows and do three shows, come to Bentonville. This was my base camp, and then go to the next one and then fly home.
Yep.
Obviously, now it's more Bike Fest. So I think this year I did five. Back in the days, when I was still competing also, I did like 10, 12. So yeah. It's not that much a difference.
Yeah, that's cool. So, I mean, obviously the shows are a big piece of what you've done, but they're just a piece. And one thing that I think is really cool about you is you've been a Red Bull athlete for 21 years. And sort of the foundation of everything is your 9-time trials world champion. But like many Red Bull athletes, you have this entrepreneurial urge, desire, like voice that can't be put to sleep.
Spark,
like you just, it has to be answered. And so it's, and I feel that too. I'm at a different stage in my career, but I find myself relating to so much of what you do because it does feel like a common thread for a lot of athletes that Red Bull ends up signing is this desire to create. And your creativity has exploded in so many different directions. And I'd love to just kind of go through, it would be fun to talk about the competitive trials career too. But, you know, right off the bat, I just have so much curiosity about how you ended up deciding to do all the things you wanted to do. So for one thing, we'll talk about Bentonville Bike Fest, which is a huge event now. If there's a type of bike riding, you have an event that's being celebrated at Bentonville Bike Fest at this point. Gravel races, mountain bike races, slope style, goes on and on. You created an entirely new type of art.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, what else? Like, let's quickly kind of, if you could describe all of the hats that you wear at this stage,
yeah,
maybe do that, and then we'll kind of work backwards on how you got there.
Well, so I started trials with the idea of competing because in the early 90s, you weren't like starting trials because you wanted to be an influencer. So it was only trials equals competing. So it was like, you know, like you probably did with your parents or with your friends going to the forest and riding a trials course, not setting your foot down. And early on, my father, who was a motor trials rider, he realized that, okay, my sons have talent, so my brother and I. And before we know, after 2 years, I think, we were already touring all over Europe.
Wow.
Competing in Spain, Barcelona. We drove Czech Republic, Slovak Republic. So my parents, our parents, they put a lot of effort in like really chasing that dream. We were winning a lot. My brother won the youth games 3 times. I was on the podium with me at the Elite World Cup in New Zealand. And then I won the Elite World Championship 4 times. In total, I have 9 world titles, like junior, cadet, elite, and then the World Cup 6 times and European Championship 4 times. Wow. So it's been really a great journey, but it was always that little frustration, like you put so much in, so much training hours. All my injuries are because of competing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just relentless. You always want to do better every day. You wake up, your body's aching, but you know, you're always trying to find a way to go forward. And I've done that until the age of 36. But early on in my 20s, I think it was when I won the world championship the second time, I was kind of frustrated. I was like, where's the media? Like, like I want to pay bills, you know? I'm an entrepreneur, but with this sport, if you only focus on the sport, there's not much you can do with it. I mean, yes, you can do all the shows and the projects. And I think that was kind of the reason why I've always been very, I mean, you can't choose to be creative. You are creative, you're not. But I always used my creativity to pursue more than just the competitive part of my sport. And yeah, so that's kind of, I think, the reason why I've and why I enjoy doing all and wearing all these different hats. It's just because, first of all, trials allows you to do it. You can do shows in a small space in front of 20,000 people. You can always you can go to school. You can be a great brand ambassador because you got something to show. But in the core and in the heart of my soul, I am a competitor. This is what I've been doing forever. It's what I value the most. Unfortunately, it's what the people know the least about me.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I've learned to deal with it because people would say, oh, this is like trick riding. What's like circus? I'm like, yeah, whatever. But when I was really young, I would get frustrated. I'm like, no, this is high level sport. It's elite sport. It's training. It's gym. It's your food. You got to be light. You got to be, it's endurance. It's interval. Like, what do you mean? You're just hopping around. I'm like, now I'm like, whatever. But if you come to Bike Fest, for example, and you see like we got all the pro riders coming, they're competing at the C1 competition. If you put them a heart rate monitor on, they're like at maximum heart rate, and they still got to perform at their best and jump from one obstacle to the other. So it's pretty high level. I'm not complaining here, but it's just been an amazing journey, and I would do it all over again. And all the shows and the creative projects, I enjoyed doing just as much. I guess also back in the days in the 90s and in the 80s, you had Hans Rey, for example.
Yeah.
He chose at one point, okay, I'm going to stop competing and just go for the project. Danny McCaskill said, I'm only going to do projects. I mean, they made choices. I never made a choice. I just decided, let me do both. If the competition season stops in September, I'm just going to do from September till January. I'll do like 50 shows, sell myself, sit on my computer, website, newsletters, emails, sponsorship, logos, printing, you know, come across really professional. And it was a lot of work, but I think it paid off.
That's interesting what you say about the athletic component and that you feel like historically people, you know, don't appreciate that when they watch trials, which makes sense, honestly. Like I can see, you know, unless you have a really trained eye, you can probably misinterpret some of what you see in trials as just a lot of practice and skill and balance work, but probably people lose sight of how are you able to create the explosivity to get from A to B when A to B is this massive gap between two tiny railings.
Which I even can't understand how the guys that are now like the top guys, they reach like insane amount of distance.
Yeah.
Like I can't even comprehend it how they get there with a bike.
That's cool. Can you tell us a little bit about what was required at the peak of your competition career to be physically prepared? You know, what sort of training were you doing? And maybe what sort of training do you do these days just to kind of keep up? Because I mean, obviously you're still doing shows at a high level. I would guess you don't have the time to dedicate to being the absolute pinnacle trials rider that you used to, because you're doing so many other things. But what is required to be a world champion trials rider from a physical standpoint?
Yeah, so it's technically eat, train, sleep, repeat thing. So I would wake up, go for a 45-minute run in the morning, then breakfast, go straight back to bed, sleep, rest your legs, do a core stability workout, and then in the afternoon do like a trial session of 2 to 3 hours. And that could be just creative writing where you like just focus on, you know, like maybe there's one technique that you're not so good at, so you really focus on that. Or it could be competition, like simulating competitions where you're like on your bike trying, because in a competition we have 5 sections. Mm-hmm. In each section you only have 2 minutes time to get to the finish line. So there could be 6 obstacles, like big ones, but it could also be 25 of them. So you really got to get used to the cardio, and the resistance has to be on point. So I would also do recovery mountain bike or road rides, lots of gym, focused on core. I have to admit, I started doing that a little bit too late. It was only when I was getting back issues that I decided to focus more on my core stability. And actually, that made me jump 2 inches higher at age 33.
No way.
Which I couldn't really understand. I was like, why didn't I do this earlier?
Yeah.
But it's very complete. It's a lot of gym, a lot of recovery training, endurance as well, like sometimes 3 hours on a mountain bike. I used to do a lot of enduro competitions because I liked the sprinting of it, and I was like giving back to my sponsors and also training, so I kind of liked that. Mm-hmm. But in general, it was about, it's a very explosive sport, so you always had to be fresh in order to improve, and that was always my issue because I was also doing all these shows, and a show might seem like a 5-minute performance, but it's the traveling to the show, setting up, waiting, warming up, riding. So in the end, you work 14 days, and that's kind of always been the hard part. My colleagues were just sleeping, training, resting 3 times a day.
Yeah.
They came to every like national competition very fresh, well-rested. I always came tired. But then my strength was always those one-day competitions, like the World Championship, the European Championship, and the World Cups. So what and my colleagues never understood. They're like, man, we saw you at the French Cup. You were like sleeping and on your bike. And now you're like, you're there every single time, 20 years in a row. I'm like, yeah, because you got a peak, you know, like that's been my strength. Like I could really say, okay, in September, third weekend of September, I'm going to be good.
Yeah.
And then I lost all the weight. Mm-hmm. I started jumping an inch higher. Mm-hmm. It was, I miss that feeling of being in such a good shape, like 7% of body fat, like ripped, veins everywhere, and then just
being a weapon.
Man, I missed that.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that's very valid. Do you find yourself able to just be so fired up about your other projects that you can kind of be at peace with the fact that you're not going to ever prioritize athleticism at that level again? And just having something else to pursue fills your cup? Is that kind of how it works?
That's, I think, very well described. I don't think I could say better.
Okay.
No, yeah. Honestly, I think that's totally right. I was at the World Championship. I went and watched as a spectator ever since I stopped competing. I always went and watched.
Oh, cool.
As a spectator.
Uh-huh.
And many people ask me, don't you miss it? I'm like, nope. Not at all. I'm at peace with whatever I had. You know, I did whatever I could do. This was the max I could do as an athlete. You know, when your body starts aching so much that every 2 training sessions you got to run to the chiropractor. They're always in pain, and it's time to just say okay. And then you know, also you get older and the kids just get younger and younger,
yeah,
and better, and I get busier, and they like it, yeah, it wasn't just fair competition anymore. Yeah. Like the next thing I could do was maybe bring the rocks inside my house or something. Because, you know, at one point it's like, what's next? Like, yeah. Can't keep repeating. And all you do also, if you want everything and if you keep going, I feel like that's if it's at a point, it looks like, you know, people should feel pity for yourself, you should feel pity for yourself almost. It's like, no, it's like, it's over, wrap it up, go on to the next project. There's plenty of challenges out there. And I think that's also the reason, like with Bikefest, that I wanted it to be the biggest, the best.
Uh-huh.
And myself and my team, we never stop until it's perfect.
Yeah.
At least we try to.
Yeah. Cool. Well, before we talk about Bikefest, I kind of want to build a little bit of a bridge here. So you moved away from competition and moved more into shows. And I'm curious what it's like. What was it like to transition from being completely focused on your own performance to being an entertainer? Because you kind of touched on that earlier, where when you were winning world titles, you know, the focus is very inward. But then when you're performing, there's this back and forth with the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's as much for them as it is for you. Yeah. Probably even more for them than it is for you. What did you discover during that phase? Like, what did you start to figure out as an entertainer? And what was that transition like? Yeah.
Well, I have to maybe correct you a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always been entertaining since the age of 9 and competing in the same time. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I would do, for example, in 2007, I did 170 shows.
What? In 1 year?
In 17 countries, in 4 continents.
Wow.
And I rode the World Cup, the European Championship, the World Championship.
Oh, my God.
And I think I won the World Cup. So I've always been juggling my time with trainings. I would literally land jet lagged in Egypt and go on an hour run in the morning, go to my hotel room, and then go do 3 shows. First show is at 10, second at 1 p.m. And then, surprise, last show will be at 2 a.m. in a nightclub.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been doing the most crazy stuff.
And was that because you wanted a proper career and professional trials? Riding?
No, these shows were my income.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like you wanted a career, and the competitive trial stuff
was my passion.
Didn't give you a career component.
Well, I should minimize that, because it helps to say, hey, we have the world champion here.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. But, and it was so much work.
And it also made it so your blade stayed super sharp.
Exactly.
When you were performing.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. And then I would put the obstacles extra far and big and challenging, and I would go extra fast because I knew I got a World Cup in 2 weeks.
Oh, interesting. So you would use the shows strategically to prepare. Man, that's crazy.
Yes.
Were there any of your competitors that were doing this?
No.
None?
None.
Wow.
They would think, he's in Egypt. We're going to beat his ass in a few weeks.
No way. Okay. What was the next step? So as you were doing these two things, almost living these two lives, professional lives at least, what was the step where you took the career component kind of to the next level? Was there something where you took the shows and like elevated them, added an element, and sort of decided, all right, this is my next move. This is going to be the next phase.
Yeah, for sure. So at the beginning of, like, I'm speaking, like, when I was 12, 15 years old, like, what do you need for your show? Oh, give me an old car and 20 pallets and 5 straps to tie them together. That was kind of the first thing. And then the next step was when I was around 17, 18 years old, we welded our own trailer, like, full of obstacles. And it was actually my dad's trailer. So we had, like, this structure welded onto it. If he needed his trailer, we could take it off with a forklift. And then he could use his trailer. And so that was another step. And then the next step, many, many years later, was the pedal to the metal concept, where Red Bull and Adidas and a few other brands, you know, joined forces in helping to make me realize that it was to build a big trailer that kind of unfolds in all kind of weird shapes with ramps and then beams sticking out, and then a DJ desk pops out, and then in front of it is like a BMX ramp. live MC, and so this kind of helped a lot to elevate the show concept, almost like a driving circus.
Yeah,
almost.
That's what like it sounded like you were just describing, one of those crazy circus rides that unfolds, and you see the semi truck driving down the road. And you're like, I wonder what that looks like when it's all set up.
Ours looks like a Red Bull racing car that's inside. So, and then we toured all over Europe, Portugal, Spain, France, Holland, all over the place, and then obviously also the NBA shows. So I got. We also have three setups in the States that travel whenever I have a show. So
three different setups.
Yeah.
Holy cow, dude.
Yes, because you need to. If I have three shows in 1 week, the stuff has to get there on time. So there's also a lot of logistics that go into it.
Yeah. Crazy, crazy. Did that pedal to the metal setup that you're describing, that sort of had multiple facets, is that where the idea for Bentonville Bike Fest started to kind of germinate at all? Because Bentonville Bike Fest is almost like the super, super, super sized version of that in a way, it feels like.
It is. I always try to understand what people like to see. And, you know, after doing trial shows for solo forever, when I add a BMX flatland, you know, you reach a different reaction from the crowd. They appreciate, they see a different sport. When you add BMX freestyle to it, again, people are like super amazed by somebody doing a backflip tail whip. And but you're absolutely right. Like the slope style line we have here, which is absolutely massive,
it is
kind of the big version of the BMX box we bring. So yeah, for sure, it is a big celebration of pedal to the metal.
So when did you decide that you wanted to launch and create a bike festival? Because that's a big step.
Yeah. So we have to go back, I think, to 2007, where for the reason that my sport was kind of dying off, my family and my trials team decided all together, we said, hey, what if we also started organizing events? So we would do nationals, some international events, some show events. And then we said, okay, let's do World Cups. And then we started doing World Cups from 2009 to 2017, always in Belgium, like on the city square in Antwerp. And I was the driving force behind it. So I would find the sponsors, be the architect of it. And then I handed over my master plan to my team. And they executed it the week off, and then they would put the grandstands and the music and the sound. And so we did some innovative stuff too with live streaming, and UCI is actually still using that concept right now. So, which is pretty cool. It elevated the credibility of the sport. We had live stream. We were live streamed on national TV in Belgium and even the UCI channel. Unfortunately, it was built too much around me because If I wouldn't be on the podium, I would lose interest of sponsors. If I didn't have sponsors, I couldn't pay for the live stream. So it was like this model where I said, this is not sustainable. I tried to push other athletes forward, but you know, they were never like world champions, or so it was hard, which was actually, it's a pity, because you know, my vision was like, okay, I'm creating this. This can live on forever. But with trials, it wasn't the case, especially not in Belgium. So in 2019, after coming to the States quite often, I said, okay, I want to start a business in the US and start doing events here. I had no idea what events or where. So I hooked up a buddy of mine who lives in Colorado. He has a trailer. So I said, every time I come to the States, I have a show. Can you drive there? And then I'll fly in, we do the show. And so this could be my first step in the business. Actually, that's where I met you then. That was the first time I met you.
Yeah.
It was 2018.
Back in Austin.
Back in Austin. Yeah. And then I ended up in Bentonville. I asked a few questions to, it was Tom Walton. I said, hey, Tom, I want to start a business in America. You got some tips and tricks. He's like, and he texted me back. He's like, where do you want to do it? I'm like, Colorado. Like, got a buddy there. He's like, no, come to Bentonville. okay, come to Bentonville. I've actually already been here 2013. I did a show at the pajama party at the 21C Hotel.
No way.
Yeah, that's how I met Tom and all the
2013 is before everything before exploded everything, here.
Yeah. Huh. They did tell me then, we want to build this mountain bike destination, global mountain bike destination, which I couldn't really believe because there was nothing. And then that was the reason he said, come back in 2018. In those 5 years, I was doing NBA halftime shows, but I never had time to come to Bentonville. And then in 2018, I came here and I was like, holy crap, this is...
what happened?
It? Like trails and bridges and jumps and the boneyard and Shrine Train and like the whole thing. And that's where the first idea came of events, because my ex-wife, she was really into events with me for the World Cups in Belgium. She knew how to do the operations and all that. So, and I had the ideas and the connections. So I pitched an idea which was called Women Shred. So women on mountain bikes championed during the Bentonville Film Festival. I got Annika Beerten here.
Oh, yeah.
Caroline Buchanan. Uh-huh. We offered workshops, change your tires, all that stuff. We had the All-American race, which was on the All-American trail, solo, like individual races.
I remember hearing about this. Yeah, yes, a time trial down All-American.
Time trial. So we had like a little event for 2 days, I guess. And I raised quite, you know, some funding from sponsors here. Was the first event, worked well.
So the Bentonville Bike Fest first was a women's specific.
Yes.
No way.
Women shred. Yeah.
That is so cool.
That was the idea.
Huh.
But at the exact same time, without knowing each other, Women of Oz got founded.
Ah.
And, you know, there was just no point in having two women-focused, you know, events or organizations, especially because they're local and we were, like, always traveling in. Yep. So it made me think, what's next? And then I said, okay, let's merge all what I am, have seen, what works, what I can do, that I know will work in an event. Let's skip all the stuff I know that will not work at an event.
Yep.
Still keep the women opponent with like Women of Oz and Women Shred, but like have all the races and all the events that we can think of and just do a festival.
Wow.
And started planning and planning and planning. I bought all the domains and the trademarks and all I could think of. Big gamble. I didn't know it was going to work. And just worked my butt off.
Yeah.
And then had to cancel in 2020 because of COVID, which was actually a blessing. Because
really?
Yeah, because I was still competing. So my time was very, I was very occupied. And this master plan, I knew was going to be a lot of work. Yeah. So that 1 year and a half extra was like a blessing for Bike Fest. Uh-huh. And then the first year we did it at 8th Street Market. In the meanwhile, I also started working with Jessie, who's local, and she has a lot of she knows a lot of people in the sponsor space. So her finding the funding with my ideas, that was like a great idea to really kick off the Bentonville Bike Fest idea. And year over year, we're growing and working relentlessly. And I spent way too many hours behind a computer now, way too many.
Yeah.
I get anxious, my ears start ringing, and because, you know, I have that energy in me that it has to get out. I mean, like I said, I've been training so hard, and that was like my outlet. If you put me too long behind a computer, I get very anxious.
Yeah. I know you're doing a decent job, though, because you ran almost 10K for Wings for Life. Shout out to Red Bull for Wings for Life, which is...
Kilometers.
What did I say? 10 miles?
Okay.
Yeah, 10 kilometers.
Okay.
you did TNT last night too, which is awesome. That's the Tuesday Night Road group ride throwdown.
Yeah.
So you're keeping fit.
Have
but
to.
I'm sure, yeah, I can't imagine. The thing that blows me away is just the, and something that I do not have the brain for, is the sheer number of plates you're spinning simultaneously and keeping organized. Because it's one thing to put one bike race on, but run us through – actually, let's just run through the entire schedule. So what are the – like bookend it with the dates and then tell us what's happening each day.
So we start on Wednesday, the 22nd of May, with and the 23rd as well, with the NBDA, National Bicycle Dealer Association, because we want to really – push forward the industry as a component of the event. So they will have a summit that's all about retailers and the industry and, you know, talks and panels, and they have 120 people sign up for it. So NBDA used to, for example, set up the Indoor Bike in Las Vegas a long time ago. So they have very well connected, and they're really helping us to grow the industry aspect of Bike Fest. So it's not just a, you know, big show with action sports and a lot of things to see. There's also actually now interest for the industry to come to Bike Fest, and that was goal number one. That's Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday evening, we have the opening night, actually right here in the Ledger on the sixth floor. It's we welcome all our sponsors, the CPG brands, the bike sponsors, the athletes, the pro athletes, the media. Everybody will be invited to come and see and listen to the people that will welcome us. There's some quite a few interesting people, like a general.
Wow.
Yes. It's a Memorial Weekend. So, So we have
long weekend.
The National Guard aspect also supporting us. There actually be a helicopter on site, a Black Hawk.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So we have that. Then Friday we start. First is the industry morning. So the people from the NBDA will go and visit all the vendors before it opens to the public. And then at noon on Friday, we'll go on all the way till 7 p.m. And it's full of action. Like, we have 160 vendors. A lot of them are brand new to, they've never been here, like Thule, Park Tool, GT Bicycles. So it's pretty rad that they want to make the trip from California and the mountain states.
Mini Sea Otter.
Yeah, Mini Sea Otter. Yeah, 160 brands is, we started.
That many, I guess. It's a lot of brands.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. And every brand has like 10 questions, 15 questions. So multiply my, so it's a lot of emails.
Yeah.
Luckily, I have a good team doing that. Friday night, we have the ritual mountain bike film tour at the Meteor Guitar Lounge. Saturday morning, we kick off with a gravel race, Gravelicious, a 30 and a 60 miler. We have a kids enduro. We got... There's so much.
Sometimes I'm putting you on the spot now.
North American Trials Championship, UCI C1 qualifier for trials. Then Saturday night, we have an amazing after party at the Meteor Guitar Lounge with an awesome DJ and a live drum performance. Then on Sunday morning, we kick off with the UCI Trials C1 Finals, which is live streamed on the UCI channel.
Cool.
Then we also have a VIP hospitality next to it, with a podcast studio, so people like yourself can go in there and talk. And we have already the Shindig, which the Trials podcast, interviewing all the Trials riders, including Hans Rey.
Oh, cool.
Then we have Adult Enduro, Adaptive Enduro, and we also have the Pedal Kids Race Series, so a miniature mountain bike race for kids down in the valley next to the field.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Slope style happen?
Slope style is in between. The dirt contest is on Sunday, the finals. And on Friday, Saturday, they're just training and doing, like, putting a show on for the people.
Yep.
All under the eye of the live DJ. So whenever they land, drop the beat.
Nice.
Because I want everything to look like you're in a YouTube video.
Uh-huh.
We don't want, like, the production level is quite high. Like, John, he runs NBA shows, so he's very familiar with entertainment. So I hired all the best people I could get to, you know, really put on a great professional show to the level of NBA. And I mean, that's the goal. With sometimes I have to say, with minimal resources, we try to do a really good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, creativity can get you a long way then.
For sure. And I know you have some pretty serious slopestyle athletes coming in the competition, like, you know, guys that do Rampage.
Yeah.
Who are some of the folks coming in to compete?
I think the most important influential rider is Ryan Williams. So Travis Pastrana says he's the best and craziest, most legendary action sports athlete of all time.
Oh, wow. That's a big crown to carry.
Yeah. He does, like, bi-weekly, he puts on a world's first at his training grounds in Australia.
Yeah.
And then he's at Nitro Circus. He's
Yeah, a good handful of the Nitro Circus guys are coming in. Yes.
We got Van Steenbergen, yeah. Rampage. We got Kyle Strait, Carson Storch. The Hyper team is bringing a whole roster of Olympians and BMX freestyle athletes. We got also Mongoose bringing in athletes, even Huffy. Might sound weird, but all these Walmart brands have actually also a pro team promoting their BMX bikes. Mm-hmm. And they're badass. Actually, it's funny how my slopestyle event became first. I had the idea of doing it on mountain bikes because we're in the mountain bike capital.
Yeah.
And then these brands started putting forward like the BMX freestyle athletes. Mm. And now it's like 50-50 BMX and mountain bike freestyle, which I think is awesome because it's unique.
It is very unique. I remember, so when I was 12, 13 years old, I was one of the kids building sketchy ramps in the yard and hucking my bike.
Yeah,
I think it was like a GT BMX race bike back in the day. And, you know, I had a subscription to BMX Plus and all that sort of thing. And I remember there was this serious rivalry between mountain bikers and BMX riders. And it was kind of like oil and water there in the early days. Like it didn't really mix. You know, the early days of slope style freeride mountain bikers were kind of, weren't into, they thought BMX was, you know, like sort of a Mickey Mouse sport, it seems like. Yeah. And then the BMXers were like, what are these guys doing with these big clunky bikes? But the fact that there's more crossover now, and it seems like, I mean, we see guys like Seminuk ride both. Plenty of the top guys are riding both.
Or Brad Simmons, you know him?
Yeah. And it's really cool that you have almost a 50-50 split between those riders competing on the same course now, which is crazy.
And now it's them against the scooters.
That's the rivalry.
No, it's, I mean, super blessed that the athletes see the value of coming to Bentonville because, you know, their sponsors have interest of having them here, putting on a show. I mean, the prize purse is pretty interesting. We got $30,000 in prizes for all the competitions, which I know is important as an athlete. Mm-hmm. You want to write for like a piece of paper, like, thanks for coming. Here's your bag with a sausage in it. So I think it's important to have a decent prize purse. I still want to up it in the future, but, you know, we go step by step.
Yep.
And the most important and probably crazy part of all is that the general attendance is free. Absolutely free.
Yep.
So that's also been the success of having plus 12,000 people coming last year.
Wow, 12,000.
Yeah.
Dang, dude.
Yeah.
So what's something, now that you're in this, like you definitely flicked a domino and now you're...
There's no way back. I got to go to the next stone every time.
Yeah. What is something that surprised you about running an event this big, with good or bad?
Well, I don't know. Being the, I don't like speaking about myself like that, the leader, I guess, of this. Mm-hmm. There's constant, you know, like adjusting audio at a concert. Like you constantly have to, like, you're working with people and individuals and emotions. And you constantly have to, like, you know, make sure everybody gets along and that you go forward. So that's kind of one thing that I underestimated, because I've been doing my thing. It was just me on the bike. If I made it, it was because of me. If I failed, it was because of me. And now if I fail, it could be because of not leading right. Mm. So this is new to me.
Interesting.
The amount of office hours is also new that I didn't expect. I mean, I've always done my own management and booking my flights. But, you know, you do your contracts in January and then kind of free day you can ride all year.
Yeah.
And a few flights on your phone. But it's just the amount of responsibility now is next level. I mean, also the, you know, people, a lot of brands pay sponsorship money. So you're, I mean, responsible for to spend it right and make sure everybody gets back. That the logos are right. I can't miss one logo, like the number plates, the badges, the amount of badges, who you give badges to. Like I can have competing sponsors to activate.
Yeah.
It's I constantly like my, I have 50 antennas out always. Like,
yeah,
it's a lot.
Yeah. We'll be there. We'll be passing through. I'm going to do a little, meet and greet with Orange Seal.
Oh, yeah. I saw them sign up.
Yeah. Yeah, they're excited.
Yeah. Glad you're coming. It's the first time, I think.
Yeah, they're stoked. So I'm excited to help them make a good first impression. Well,
yeah.
I'm not sure if we've firmed up a time yet, but we'll be sure to push that out to folks. That's cool, man. It's crazy. What you were saying before we started recording is that it's kind of like you didn't necessarily know what you were getting yourself into.
No.
But it's a journey, and you have that athlete mindset where you just want to achieve and improve and see what's possible. And so,
yeah, like I said, it's like you start climbing this mountain and the views only get better as you go up.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's always different. And yeah, it's just, but it seems to be like an endless mountain with something like this, because technically you can keep growing. If it's not in size, it's in quality. If it's not in quality, you know, customer experience, and every year the correction of errors, like we analyze everything and say, okay, next year let's do this better. And then it's like a sports career.
Yeah.
It's never perfect.
Right. Well, speaking of, here's a question. How much have you felt the industry struggle right now? Like, obviously the industry is going through a little bit of a economic correction, as I think many CEOs are using in their PR statements.
Yeah. I think it's real. It's there. You hear a lot of people saying, hey, we're not selling out our stock. We have overstock. We struggle. We can't. A few of them like canceled last minute because they weren't ready. Mm-hmm. I think it's real. It's definitely there. I think the advantage of being in Bentonville is because it's so important for the industry to come here.
Yeah.
That I think that's my advantage for having the Bentonville Bike Fest. I think they still want to come here and probably cancel a few other things to come here because it's important and to save what can be saved.
Yeah.
And I think we're in a good spot as a festival. But in general, the industry is definitely struggling. I can even tell, like, a lot of colleagues lost, including myself, as a the other part of me, the professional athlete, lost a lot of sponsorship contracts because there's just no budget.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's there, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and it's always interesting being kind of behind the curtain on some of that stuff, because there's certainly times where, budgets get cut a lot. And then there's other times where budgets get cut because they want to get ahead of the curve a little bit.
Yeah.
And so it sort of compounds a bit.
Yeah. I do think the industry made a few mistakes, like, you know, because of COVID.
I think
Over-investing, thinking this is going to last forever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, of course, do other economical aspects that they couldn't foresee. All of a sudden it stops. Would have been maybe better to sell out and then have a drink at the bar.
Yeah.
And wait it out
until
the next order comes, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. Just chatting with some of my friends that work at various companies, you know, some of them are kind of chuckling because it's like, you know, you see these things come out that sales are down 30% or 40% or whatever. And it's like, compared to the absolutely insane spike that was the pandemic, you know, if you compare it to pre-pandemic, like it's maybe not quite as dire. And so it is just a bit of a natural correction, but, it's a reminder too. And, I'm sure in your position, it requires a little bit of extra nimbleness now and then, even if you are somewhat protected from it, from being here in Bentonville.
Yeah.
One thing I am curious about is as you're climbing this mountain, like you're describing, and you need to stop and just take in the view for a minute. What are you doing? Like, how are you, when you step away from the laptop, is it trials training sessions? Is it run here and there? Like, what's your escape these days?
I do a little bit of CrossFit.
Okay.
I do trials.
Yep.
Running and road or gravel and lots of mountain biking.
So because, some of everything, all the bikes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's been the main reason I competed at a very high level, like until 37, is because I had a lot of variation in my training. I didn't just want it to be 4 hours a day on a trials bike. I did all these other sports, and that's what kept it interesting. I'm a person, I need a lot of variation. I can't do one thing all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's ADHD, I don't know. But it kept me go longer and do it longer. And I think because I miss it so much, I still like try to have a variety of sports in my life.
Yep.
Because whatever I do on the business side, I need to get out there and work out. Yep. No matter what. And also I have to because I still have shows. I can't show up 30 pounds overweight.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm here. Put my Red Bull helmet on. That just doesn't work. And it's a challenge. I mean, it's just me, you know, it's like yourself, eating healthy. Yeah. After 25 years, it becomes a habit. You don't want to change it.
Yep. Yeah, habits are everything.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so you mentioned a minute ago how diversity is important for you and your happiness. I think probably a lot of athletes can relate to that. When you live at a certain speed and you have gotten to travel a certain amount, it can be hard to settle in to one place or settle into one routine for sure. Yeah. You spent a lot of time here. I assume you spent a decent amount of time in Belgium still.
Like now, unfortunately, we had two people. My father-in-law passed away. My mother was sick. So we spent a lot of time in Belgium this year, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, we minimized it, especially before our baby.
Yeah.
We were just all over the place. Like, let's go 4 weeks to Spain. Let's go just say hello one day in Belgium and then fly to America. Because, you know, Brussels is a good connector.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the lifestyle. Now with the baby, it's more of... it's a little bit more organized.
Okay.
And more in Belgium, yes.
Yeah. Oh, more in Belgium now.
Yeah, because I find it like I always said, no, I'm going to move and I'm going to go wherever I want to live. But if I think back to my childhood, I'm like, I find it quite pretty important that I knew my grandfather, my grandmother, my nieces, my nephews.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take that away from my kid. So
interesting.
I'm going back to Belgium more than I plan to.
Yeah. That's really nice to recognize that. Yeah. I got to imagine it's quite the adjustment to go from living as a peak athlete and having your entire day-to-day focused on your own performance.
Yeah.
But now you're responsible for a little being who you want to give a good life to.
Yeah. And I am super glad we waited for so long. My wife had a career in aviation. She worked for Qatar Airways. So she traveled the world every week almost in a different continent for 9 years. And so she's used to traveling. Then myself, I did what I did. And now, you know, having the kid, and honestly, we love it here in Bentonville so much because it's all designed for kids. Like yesterday, we went to Pedal Kits USA, the old buddy packs. And he was on a Strider bike with four others doing laps and having a coach. I mean,
there's toddler group rides even.
Yeah, like this is so cool. Like, and I can't wait for him to pedal and then go on the trails, which is, well, I live like 100 feet from Kohler.
Yeah.
So we kind of like it here more than we do in Belgium. Just unfortunate that our family's not here.
Yep.
So we'll travel.
I know you also have a place in Spain because when we were in Girona this winter, you shot me a message. You're like, hey, if you want to shoot down to Calpe, just FYI, you got a landing pad.
Still counts. The offer still stands.
Sweet. Tell me about that. Is that just, I mean, much of Europe appreciates the climate of coastal Spain.
Yeah,
so is that how that came about?
I think everybody from Belgium is soon going to move there, which is actually like Belgian law, IRS changed a lot of the regulations. You can't write off stuff in Spain anymore because there's been like a peak of people just leaving.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of restrictions now.
Interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, that's something else. But I broke my wrist. I fell OTB during a World Cup in 2012, in my hometown, in front of my home audience, which was awesome. I still carried on, but it hurt like hell. But yeah, so that for the first time got me off the bike. I decided to go to Spain, take a little break, like honestly, like literally never been longer than 2 weeks off my bike, so I didn't know what to do. And then went to Spain. I said, you know, I want to invest here. I think it's going to be good for my career. And I did and found a place, and it was the best investment I could ever do.
Really?
Yeah, because Belgium, you're always training in the rain, in the cold, hail, storms. Yep. Then you got to go inside. So I think over a course of a year, somebody living in Spain and training in Spain probably trains 30% more than we did. So yep. It just wasn't fair anymore. So I invested in a place in Spain. And every time I went for the next 10 years, 2 weeks prior to an important competition, my level would just jump in the ocean in the morning. Man, I felt so good.
That's cool.
It's been a very strategic investment.
Yeah.
And I also knew that once I retire, it's still there. It's just surf for something else.
Yeah. So you operate that one and the one in Bentonville here as an Airbnb some of the year. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's sort of what we've settled on as well. And it's funny because we get the question, understandably, so what's home now? Like, where do you live?
Yeah, we have the same problem.
Yeah, and so I've sort of, it's weird though, and it's such a privilege.
It's a privilege.
To get to live in such great places.
Yeah.
But I do, there is this element of not having a home, per se. Is that something that you struggle with at all?
I don't necessarily. I got used to it. My wife sometimes does. Like, I'm all over the place. I got bags here. I got bags there.
Yeah.
I you know, it's like, yeah, I'm like, let's go to Bentonville.
Yeah.
It's where everything is there. But then we're like, the family. So we still decide to go back and forth. Yeah. But yes, it's not easy. I know what you mean. I've been doing that for, as far as I can remember.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing is when you've been living on the road since 12, it's easier to settle into that.
Yeah, yeah. But it's definitely, to your point, it's definitely true. Like, also, like, you're like my friends that I used to grow up with.
Yeah.
I'm sure I can call them tomorrow, say I have a problem, they will help me. But you kind of lose the distance, you know?
Of course.
You kind of lose it. And then when I'm here, there's certain people that I meet regularly. But then at one point, you're going back for a month or 2 months. So you never have that, like, deep connection with people, I think. Like, and that's something I always know, like, I got really homesick when I would be gone for an NBA show and then Easter weekend, for example. You're there by yourself in your hotel room.
Yeah.
And then you see people going out with their moms and dads.
Yeah.
And like, damn, it's a lot of sacrifice,
what
we do. Yeah. And people always see the bright side of, you're going on a holiday again. Not really. Like, people now in Belgium think I'm on a holiday here. I mean, I understand. Like,
I'm on a holiday where I work 80 hours a week.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, whatever. But yeah, I'm just very fortunate that my wife is still able to follow me. She's applying for a job that might change one day. One day my kid has to go to school.
Yeah.
So then life will change. But until then, we're still freestyle a bit.
Yeah. No, it totally makes sense. I hear much of what you're saying and can relate to it. A couple more things before we wrap this thing. You mentioned your wife working on Qatar Airways, which reminded me of your stint in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
Touring. Before we started recording, you started to share some pretty interesting stories. Talk to me about how that came about, because you basically were performing in a bunch of countries that I wouldn't typically associate with, bike riding hotbeds, per se.
No, for sure not. So Red Bull was actually the driving force behind hiring me for the first ever international trip I did for Red Bull was in Saudi Arabia. So they wanted to bring the brand to Saudi, open the market. So like, hey, you know, you come do shows and convince these people, like, hop over them.
Hop over them.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. But I was in the most weird places. Like, all of a sudden, they pulled me out of the airport. I couldn't wear shorts because back then, now Saudi has opened up and it's very, like, westernized. Back then, you couldn't wear shorts in public.
You got pulled in the airport?
Airport, yeah. Go put on your pants, your trousers.
No way.
That was different.
When was this? Mid-2000s?
2001.
Okay. 2001, yeah.
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 Whoa.
Way back. Yeah.
How old were you then?
Seven.
Yeah.
Eight.
damn, I'm old.
It's all relative. That's how I feel about some of the guys I'm racing now.
Yeah.
I'm old.
Yeah, it's all right. But yeah, no, I mean, and then you got to perform here, but no music because it's a religious university. And the year after, I said, I'm never going back to that country ever again. And the year after, they called me, Red Bull Lebanon. They said, hey, you want to do a tour in Lebanon, then in Jordan, and then in Kuwait? Whew. I'm like, no, I'm not going back. I don't want to. No, Kenny, Lebanon is amazing. And Red Bull Lebanon trip, 2004, post-competition season, like October, still the best trip ever.
Really? Yeah, why?
I don't know. There was something about those people because, first of all, I came at the airport and they saluted me in French.
Huh.
Because I speak French because of Belgium.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, what? I didn't do my research, I guess. I'm like, it used to be a French colony.
Huh.
So they speak French, Arabic.
Uh-huh.
So I had a good connection with the people and I had the craziest parties on the beach and it was just a great experience. Great people. Still today, these same people are like, I still know them. They're still my friends.
Okay.
Yeah, because they all moved the year after. Unfortunately, one of their presidents got executed and the whole country collapsed in 2005. And then all these people, Red Bull Lebanon, they all became general managers from, I think it was even Egypt, Japan, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. And that's when they started calling me. And then every year I did like three trips to the Middle East.
Isn't it amazing how it all goes back to people?
Oh, man.
It's crazy.
Everything. Like when you underestimate.
Yeah, when you watching from afar, and I've learned to kind of keep some perspective about this, but when you see someone like yourself, like, man, he's touring to every country in the Middle East, it seems like right now. What an amazing experience. And how is that happening?
People. Connections.
Connections, people.
I mean, you probably have the same saying in Belgium. You say it's important what you can do, but it's more important who you know.
Huh.
So if you combine both, then you're... And always like try to not just give me, but also think about, what can that person benefit from what I want? And and if you establish relationships like that, then your career will go to big heights.
Mm.
But yeah, it's been the Pakistan trip was interesting.
Yeah, tell me about that. How did that come about? Was that a similar reason?
I didn't want to do it again because of safety reasons.
Uh-huh.
They convinced me saying, after Pakistan, you go to Sri Lanka, and after Sri Lanka, you go to the Maldives.
Ah, like, there you go.
I'll do the Pakistan trip. So I came from the airplane. And there's a guy standing like ready with a shotgun like that. Like,
whoa!
Like how you call the last part of your gun? When they cut off the.
Oh, like a sawed-off shotgun.
Yes, a sawed-off shotgun.
Oh my God!
And he looked like B.A. Baracus. So I felt safe, of course.
No. Wow.
And then he went...
This guy was your guard.
Yes. He went everywhere with me, to my shows, universities.
Jeez, man.
Like all these...
fun with things. A sawed-off shotgun?
Yes.
Oh my, that's like out of a movie.
It was pretty fun.
What?
And then I did two shows, 2 days in one city, 2 days in the next, 2 days in the next. And so I went from east to west. Sorry, west to east. And then I think it was the fifth day, they called me and said, Kenny, that first day, your shoot at that shrine where they all pray and stuff, that got like, there was a car bomb.
Ugh.
And 100 people died.
Oh,
I was like, whoa. So yeah, that was,
jeez.
That makes you think sometimes about the safety of the places I went. Nigeria was also interesting.
Wow. How did Nigeria come about?
It was my brother and I, and we spent a lot of time in the hotel room. We couldn't get out. Like, a lot of shows got canceled. And we still remember like the plugs in the wall when the electricity shut down and the generator kicked in. There was like a flame this big shooting out of the wall.
Nicole is nodding right now. She's spent some time in places like this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It was pretty... I mean...
Yikes.
It puts... Like, what I value the most about visiting all these places is how I put everything in perspective.
Uh-huh.
All the Western problems we have, to me, sometimes are not problems. It's luxury problems, and it's maybe... a little issue, and you can solve it by talking about it or giving it some time and reflect on it, and like then realize it's not such a big problem. But the real problems, like when we were in India with like 2-3-year-olds all covered in dirt begging for a little bit of money. Mm. I mean, those are the real problems in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For yeah. Sure. I mean, here in other parts of the world, we just create ways to sink imaginary frustrations into social media or whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's normal. Like, not everybody has a chance to go.
Yeah, it's true. That's a really important thing to remember also. And yeah. You're so right. Like, the privilege to travel and to gain that perspective is such a privilege. And it's easy to be hard on folks who maybe have not had the opportunity to gain that perspective.
That's why there's podcasts. Spread the message. it's been amazing, honestly. All the trips and the travels, and been really privileged. And then, yeah. But now I'm in Bentonville.
Yeah, let's put a bow on it with your stint as an artist.
Oh yeah, the art,
because that's a really interesting one. You know, a lot of what you've done has connections and flow that makes sense. You know, you can kind of connect the dots.
Yeah.
I see why that came after that. But at what point did you say, I'm going to use my bike as a paintbrush?
Yeah.
Because what were the dots that aligned before that one?
I'm telling you, I have a weird brain. Sometimes I'm like, nah, that's a great idea. And 2 minutes later, nah, it's not. So I don't know, like riding for Red Bull, you know, you probably too, is you get asked the question a lot, like, hey, what's your next idea, project, bucket list?
Mm-hmm.
And for many, many years, like I think now already 15 years, I had the idea of putting up like a big canvas and just have my tires covered in paint and do something and create a pattern. That was the first idea. And it's actually thanks to Bentonville as well that I started it, because Lieven Bertels, he's a Belgian who used to be the director of the Momentary.
Mm.
So he, of course, there were two Belgians here. Of course, I met him.
The only two in Bentonville.
and he's like, he was brainstorming about the Momentary. You know, he's in his exploring phase. How can we make that a cool place, and et cetera, et cetera. And he asked me like, hey, can you do something crazy? I'm like, Lieven, I have this idea of like canvas and just create art on it. Like, he's like, let's do that. And you know what? Let's go to Art Basel in Miami and have a Momentary booth there with your art in it. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
No pressure. No,
hold your horses.
For those that don't know, Art Basel is a massive.
Massive. Like,
massive. Yeah,
like crazy. I call my buddy. He's an artist. My high school friend, but like even from kindergarten. So he's all in art. He knows everything about mixing colors and paints and oil and acrylics and like the brushes and everything. So I'm like, hey, Floris, is his name Floris? You got to help me, buddy. So he's like, okay, let's do abstraction. And like, and I started going really deep into it. I was looking at all the documentaries, the abstract artists, like their history, their life path, the art they made, like what, like Google, like you were like Google, what makes abstract art interesting? Like I watched hundreds of hours of like footage just to really start to understand what it is. Mm. And then my brain just got more creative. Like I wasn't trying to copy anyone. I was just trying to understand the process. And then I started enjoying it so much. And I made a first draft mm-hmm. of my artwork to show the people here about what I was doing. And then they realized, including me, like, no, this is too early to show at Art Basel. We shouldn't link our multi-million dollar museum to that. That's a bad idea.
That's hilarious. And I was like,
give me a few more moments to do this. And then I just went all in. Like, I made so many artworks.
So then being COVID told hit. That it wasn't good enough,
yes,
didn't give you, didn't kill your interest.
No, it only sparked my fire to go harder and study it more and
cool.
do better and learn and experiment. And yeah, and then the idea came of the Anything for the Stripes, where I like do the UCI rainbow jersey mm-hmm. and the rainbow colors. Mm-hmm. And that was like, I think, the artwork that really gained credibility in the art world as well. Like, oh, this is not just, because the lines have to be so straight that they said, this is not just messing around with paint. He actually knows what he's doing now. And I think from there on, it gained credibility in both bike world and art world.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So did you start experimenting with different types of tires and that sort of thing?
Tires, rims.
Wow.
I make a mess always when my buddy who paints, like when he uses paint, is like a little dot.
Yeah.
And then he goes like, shh.
Yeah.
And I'm going like half a gallon at once. Because you know, big tires canvas. Take so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
But unfortunately, all the projects I'm doing now, like during COVID, like almost every artwork I made in COVID got sold directly over the internet. Mm. And then Bike Fest became bigger and bigger and bigger. And I have to admit that I have less and less time to be creative. Yep. But once Bike Fest is over, we go into summer and that's when I start again.
Oh, cool.
Because I can't, like some people ask me, hey, can you quickly make an artwork? I can't. Like,
they keep, dance, monkey, dance.
Yeah, no, you got to be in a mental state where you're like into it. You can't just do it. You got to be into it. And then that's when it works.
That's interesting. Is the headspace similar to when you were competing at all?
Yeah. I would start and think, I'm going to quickly do this, to the point where I'm like, you know, the
world gets very small.
Eye of the tiger, and you're like focused on what you're doing. And that's why I want to have time when I do it and not just do it.
Can people, I'm sure there's a video or two online where people can.
Yeah, on my Instagram account, I have an Instagram account dedicated to it. I think it's BillayKenny_bikeart.
Uh-huh.
Or on my YouTube channel, there's a few videos out there.
Okay, we'll link that.
Yeah, but I can't wait to retire. I don't know when it's going to be, but I do this full time.
The art?
Yeah.
Really?
This is my dream.
No way.
A studio in Spain and just making art every day. I must say, as a businessman, it can be quite frustrating.
Huh.
Because
what do you mean?
Sometimes you'll see an artwork, you're like, $8,000? Like, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But don't forget, probably you won't sell anything for 4 months. So it's not like you're selling bread. It's like the right time, the right spot, the right customer. And then when you sell, what I also learned is the galleries, they take like 50%.
Oof. Brutal.
Brutal. It's a tough business as an artist.
Interesting.
So it throws me back to being a trouser rider. But I love it. I love it. I never done anything for money.
So I've seen videos of this. So yeah. I'm not feeling as compelled to ask what it looks like. But we should address that from a mechanics standpoint. Yeah. How do you actually do the painting?
So now I just tape canvas to the floor. So there's no space or a canvas, actually. I mean, a piece of wood sticking out, so it's like flush to the floor.
Yeah.
And then I kind of know what I'm... Sometimes I really know what I want, and that's technically when it's with lines and when I do straight lines and make patterns like that. And then I would, for example, take the tires off my front wheel and just have the rim.
Hmm.
And then I can use that like as a tool to create lines, straight lines.
A precision.
Curved lines. And then I just keep building from that. There's also techniques where I would have a can cut open on the top. I cut it off. And then I fill it with a mixture of, it's like, kind of like water, but it's a product. It just makes it more liquid, and with acrylic paint, and then I splash on it. So I create like a splash, and then I could sometimes tape off where I want it to be splashed, and that could look like a tree. Mm-hmm. And then I have these techniques where I do like skids, but like I reverse. So I pull the paint away, and then I have all these different colors that like are really like almost like printed into the canvas. Sometimes it's so slippery I fall on my head.
Oh wow! Interesting. I didn't think about
like,
that.
It's like you're riding on ice at one, because most of my tires are slick tires.
Yeah.
So no grip at all, and then yeah, the amount of times I just like, I'm like, really? There's no obstacles here.
That's amazing, man. Are there any pieces in Bentonville on display right now?
Yes. If you go to the Meteor Cafe.
Yeah.
If you go to the restroom, there's an art print there against the wall. I sold one to the Chamber of Commerce a long time ago, and they auctioned it to somebody. The winner must be somewhere in Arkansas. I don't know where it is. And there's also an art print at the Momentary in the art store, museum store, sorry.
Cool.
Mainly prints, actually.
Yeah.
Real artworks? No, not yet. Oh, yes, at a Airbnb owner at Kohler Retreat next to our festival field, actually. Yeah. There's also an artwork over there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
When we get ready to turn our place over into an Airbnb here later in the year, maybe we need to figure out what it would take to have a bit of art on the wall.
Just call me.
Kenny Belay Art. Yeah.
One idea I have is to have a bike fest office here. And like one part would be people working on Bike Fest, and the other walls would all be covered with my art. A place for people to grab a coffee.
Nice.
Yeah. But then I have to live here permanently.
Yeah. Right now, that's one idea too many.
One idea too many.
In due time.
Yeah. There's only 24 hours, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah. I was going to say that earlier. Everyone inevitably only has 24 hours.
And by time.
But it's impressive what some people do with those 24 hours.
Yeah. I want to add something to that. You hear all these people, CEOs, talking about teams. So I started experimenting in that, and you got to lead team and you got to let other people do it. It's actually true.
What do you mean?
If you have a good team around you, if you build the right people around you who can do things better than you, man, then you can go like to the next level.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's something I had to experiment, and because obviously, like again, as an individual athlete, you're not familiar with that kind of way of working, and something I learned and value a lot right now.
That's cool. I bet that's a really fun process also.
Yes.
Because it has a bit of a creative element too. It's subtleties that make it successful.
And letting go, not trying to do everything yourself.
I bet that's hard as an athlete.
And then all of a sudden you have more time during a day.
Yeah. More time to skid around on canvas with paint on your tires, maybe.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Thanks, Kenny. I mean, you are a prototypical Red Bull athlete in all the best ways, and it's really cool to catch up with you.
Same thing. Thanks for having me, Payson.
You bet, man. It was way too long in the coming. I can't believe we didn't do one of these earlier, but
we waited the right time. We have more to say now.
We do. See you at Bike Fest.
See you at Bike Fest.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. A big thank you to Kenny for giving us a solid hour plus of his time. He's such a busy guy, ramping up last couple of weeks here before his big Bentonville Bike Fest event. Be great to see some of y'all there. Like I said at the top of the show, I'll be doing a meet and greet / signing with Orange Seal, I think at 10 a.m. on Friday, the 24th of May. And speaking of Orange Seal, quick shout out to them for supporting today's show. They're my longest running sponsor, and their sealant has saved many a training ride and race for me over the years. I run it in all my bikes, even my commuter. And I remember vividly, just as an example, my first ever Leadville in 2017, I smashed a rock, sliced my tire coming down power line, which is pretty early in the race. And Orange Seal sealed it up at about 10 PSI or so, and I was able to hit it with a CO2, just
lose very minimal time, pin it back up to the lead group, and manage to podium that day. So it's been a game changer, almost on like a day-to-day basis. It's something that I rely on. So I highly recommend you go to orangeseal.com and pick up some fresh sealant for yourself today, regardless of what style of bike riding you enjoy. I want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing the show today, and a big thank you to Nicole Baker for producing the show. We've been recording these in person at Ledger Bentonville, and it's quite the state-of-the-art facility there. And so Nicole has lots of dials and levers that she has to keep an eye on. It's pretty fun. And of course, continues to record a bit of video for our social channel, The Adventure Stash, over on Instagram. So if you'd like to see some video to go along with today's episode, you can do so at The Adventure Stash on IG. And also you can play our Friday quizzes there too. Other than that, I think that'll do it for this week. I should admit that I never got that next YouTube video up, next visual podcast of Santa Vi Stage 2. It's been pretty busy as I kind of dive into a bit of panic training here, honestly. I'll get that up ASAP. I'll let you know as soon as it is up. Thank you all so much for listening today, and we will catch you next week.